Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Troy Nunes is an Absolute Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casillo, and with me today is Dan Lyons.
Happy bye week.
Happy bye week. The fighting byes come to town. We are 6.5-point favorites, as Sean pointed out on Monday. I have more faith than usual we can beat the byes. Scott Schaefer made things look a little close for a few years there, but yeah, I think the streak's going to continue.
Yeah, I mean, the bye has just been kind of listless this year. Obviously, the offense, I think, will catch them off guard. They haven't faced an offense like this. I mean, they played Texas, but, you know, everyone played Texas well this year. I'm pretty confident. I think we'll definitely notch one this weekend for sure.
Way to go, team. Last week we faced Boston College.
The
Fighting Byes.
Colloquially on bye week.
And Meathead Steve Adazio, who's definitely getting fired. And yeah, did you catch that whole aftermath, not just with like our stuff, but then what he was saying about hating criticism and on social media? And he was talking about like Twitter muscles and all this other crap. And he sounded like Scott Schaefer. And it was really funny to watch him, like, kind of unwind. Like, he thought that he was, like, engendering some sort of, like, sympathy from the fan base. And then, like, I saw, like, all the guys at BCI just pretty much, like, lit him on fire in the comments.
Yeah, I mean, it was very familiar. Steve, like... Similar playbook, which is not surprising because Adazio and Steve... it's actually kind of weird. It's actually weird because Adazio is an offensive guy. But, hey, Adazio, the reason that people don't like you as a coach is because your quarterbacks went 7-for-20 for 64 yards.
Right. Like, you've completed 9 passes against us in the last 2 seasons combined.
A dreadful pass defense.
Like, one of the
like
worst.
A really bad pass defense, both years. I don't know. It was right out of the same playbook as Schaefer last year, trying to divert blame or, like, push the focus on other things, whether it's ISIS or Twitter or... literally anything else. The thing with Brad Whitney on the sideline, which was weird, and, you know, obviously there was something happened there, but it wasn't like the focal point of the reason BC lost. No. So, nice one for Syracuse. The fact that they've now moved the ball effectively and scored some points against two really good, or I'd say one really good defense and one
inflated garbage opponent's defense.
Yeah, but also still, like, fairly good.
Still top 40, but definitely not the top 10 ranking they were coming in with.
No, I think BC was probably, like, a top 30 to 40, and VTech is, like, in the probably 10 to 15 range. Legitimately. And Syracuse put up good numbers in its book. Not great numbers, you know, what this offense will be in a couple of years, but, like, first year against teams that were very well. I mean, if anything, BC and VTech are both really well established on the defensive side. Obviously, Virginia Tech brought in its whole, you know, defensive coaching staff for the most part from the last staff, and BC's the whole same staff, except for, you know, they lost their defensive coordinator, but it's still like the same defense and everything. And they, you know, they did really well. Dungy continues to put up like top 10 historical passing games in the Syracuse record books pretty much every week, and he was also super efficient this week, 11.4 yards an attempt, which. In some games this year, he's put up like big numbers, but the yards per attempt haven't been there. Like, he was getting the ball downfield and making big chunk plays, which was nice. So, there are still things to take away. And, you know, the running attack was nothing, you know, nothing to write home about, although BC's pretty good against the run. But I think we should. It's never good, and it was about the same this week. The passing game, I thought the spreading the ball was really impressive. You had 4 guys that were over 78 yards. I think there was a lot to be very happy about.
Yeah, I mean, you bring up some good points on the offense, and it's funny because I know you said there, like, you know, it was a good game, wasn't a game that would look like it would in a couple years, and like all that said, and like we definitely don't think the offense performed to its the top of its capabilities. They still managed 532 yards against this defense, half in a rainstorm. So yeah, I'm very, very encouraged by the future here, and I think, you know, people said that after the Virginia Tech game. There was reason to be optimistic even after the Colgate game, but I think what we've seen for 2 straight weeks here is just a distinct and clear ability for this team to move the football. And yes, they're not finishing drives necessarily as much as we'd like them to, but the fact that we have, you know, them finishing drives enough, the fact that we have them, again, putting up over 500 yards of offense two straight weeks against very good defenses. Like you said, Dungy, efficient as hell, 32 for 38. You know, what he was doing against that defense was a clinic in how to run this kind of, you know, up-tempo spread. I know I've mentioned this a couple times now. The announcers, you know, talked about it a little bit, about what this offense was doing to BC and forcing them to really, like, you know, kind of sell it on the blitz if they had any chance of stopping SU from moving the ball. And it was, you know, every time they went man-to-man, there was always going to be a linebacker matched up with one of the slot receivers. And that's how you saw those couple seam plays with Phillips and Esteem, because, you know, they don't have the personnel at BC necessarily to trot out a guy for nickel. Also, if you're going to trot out a guy to play a nickel package, you're probably going to give up a little bit more in the run game. But every time they played zone, it allowed for, you know, some real soft holes right around the line of scrimmage. And when you have really fast guys, like pretty much all four of our starting receivers and the only guys who see the field for the most part at the receiver spot, any of those four guys, if you give them a couple yards, they're at least going to gain you five, as we've seen all season. So again, like, it just put BC in a quandary, and I don't think that, you know, things are solved necessarily. Obviously, we only scored 28 points. We still stalled out a bunch in, like, the, you know, BC 40 to 25 range, which is frustrating. But you're starting to see Dungy really figure out the formula that works for him and works for this offense. And, I mean, 434 yards is incredible. I felt like it was a largely effortless 434 yards as well. Obviously, he was under pressure a bit. But by and large, I felt like he threw the ball incredibly well. He had some of the best passes I've probably ever seen from him. I called out a couple of them in the play calling article, where he just kind of laid it right into receivers' hands. And I think we're going to see more and more growth there. And you know, Dan, looking forward to, like, next year, imagine Dungy, yes, without Editawo and yes, without Esteem, but with an offensive line that's probably going to be better next year. You have to love what's going to happen next.
Yeah, I think, I don't think it's a huge stretch, and we finally saw him put together, like, a really good game. I don't think it's a stretch to say Ishmael might maybe not put up these numbers that Editawo was putting up, but, like, kind of fill that hole as, like, the clear number one. I mean, this has been, like, weirdly, like, it's his best statistical season, which, obviously, based on the offense, it was going to be. It's, like, it's almost, like, his most underwhelming season, and then you look, and he's still, like, making good plays, and I think part of the thing is that Adetawa has been so good that it's just kind of taking the shine off him a little bit. But this was, like, his first really big, like, performance.
Right.
The 8-for-108 and a touchdown. The touchdown catch was gorgeous.
He could have had another one.
He could have had another one.
Esteem could have had another one. Esteem could have had another one. Yeah, Ishmael's lost at least two touchdown passes. Ishmael also, I pointed this out on the Sunday post about stats, Ishmael's, like, ninth all-time in receptions now at SU.
Like, yep, and next year, I mean, I think he'll be going for, like, an 80-90 reception year, for sure.
Yeah, and it's funny, too, because I remember, like, in Bill Connolly's post previewing the season, you know, one of his big points about wide receivers was, you know, draft Steve Ishmael for your college football fantasy team. And it's funny that, like, that didn't come to fruition, and it obviously did for somebody else in Ahmed Atawo, but I think maybe that prediction might have just been a year ahead. And you look at, you know, what's coming down the pike. You have three, you know, guys who run a sub 4.5 40 potentially coming in for 2017 right now. You have Riley and Butler. I don't really know what Butler's injury is, and we never really saw him, like, leave the field with an injury against Wake Forest, but he's been out the last 2 weeks now. Riley seems like a guy with promise. What I'd like to see, though, I think Butler and Riley fill more roles in the slot position, so you have to hope that at least two of the guys that come in are going to be a little bit more geared towards those deeper routes that, you know, eventually Steve Ishmael is going to graduate after next season. And, I mean, or knock on wood, who knows what happens after this year. And obviously Editawo and Esteem to a lesser extent are both gone after this year.
Yeah, I mean, I really like how it seems like the last 2 weeks and this week especially, we've kind of seen, like, these guys kind of filling in where they were supposed to. And obviously there isn't as much rotating in and out, and you don't have the freshmen coming in as much, but you kind of have very defined roles for the four receivers, and they both seem very comfortable, or they all seem very comfortable with where they are. And you saw it this week with all of them putting together among their better performances of the year. And the fact that Dungy is able to get them all the ball is really nice, because it seems like he's really finding his place in the offense as well.
Agreed, and I think like that's one thing that folks are going to notice more and more, and I think national pundits are starting to come around to a little bit. I mean, no, Dungy's not going to be looking at All-America consideration or even All-Conference consideration, despite the numbers, but what you're seeing now is a more complete quarterback. I mean, you still don't love the called, you know, quarterback draws, but at the same time, like, how else are we going to move the ball? He made some really smart, heady runs. I felt like he picked up some big yardage when we really needed it against BC. Including that big kind of third down conversion, you know, to kind of, you know, seal the win and extend that drive. He just, you can tell, and we said this last year too, like, he's somebody who is getting better and better each week he plays, and the best medicine for him is just more reps and more game time. He's a smart guy. He's a cerebral guy. Yes, he's going to make some risk-related mistakes. Obviously, that fumble in the fourth quarter was also a bit rough to watch. But, I mean, again, by and large, like, you look at what he was doing early in the season, where he pretty much just came out every game and threw to Irv Phillips 4 to 7 times, threw to Edetawa when he wasn't throwing to Phillips, and then ignoring Esteem and Ishmael completely. And now you're seeing a guy who, you know, stays in rhythm, stays on point with the offense, like, keeps the team moving on his own. He made two gorgeous throws on the run against the Eagles, and in general, he just, yeah, he's finally, like you said, spreading the ball around and understanding where each receiver fits into this offense. It can really help him, again, continue to succeed and continue to make this offense look better and better each week. Because, you know what, like, I think Bill Connelly mentioned this, and I think you and me have mentioned this too, like, we're not seeing the points that we necessarily expected with this Syracuse team this year, but the fact that the yardage is there, and it's really just, I think, in large part, offensive line related issues and maybe some turnover problems that related to youth. The fact that the yardage is there and the penetration into the opposing zone is there already, like, you're seeing a team that is managing to get into the opponent's side of the field, you know, 60-70% of drives. Like, to me, that's frustrating now, but it does give hints of something that's going to flip, a switch that's going to flip. Once the offensive line issues get set up, and once this team is, you know, 14, 15, 16 games into the new system come next year.
Yeah, and I think that was one of the things that we were looking for this season, was this, like, active development that you didn't have to, like, look that hard to identify, and the fact that it's coming with Dungy is really, really cool. So, I think it's too early to, like, just make determinations on what this season is or what, like, Syracuse has been this year. But I think we've probably hit the four-win – I mean, we've hit the four-win mark that you probably would have generally signed for. You obviously traded, like, you thinking you beat Wake Forest, but then definitely thinking you would not beat Virginia Tech, and you swapped those two. Obviously, NC State's a winnable game, though Syracuse won't be favored at all. You know, maybe you can talk yourself into stealing Pitt, but, like, I think overall it's hard to, unless something disastrous happens down the stretch here, I think it's hard to say anything but the season has at least hit, like, the solid, like, B mark in terms of success. Now, if they make a bowl, if they go out and beat NC State and slip in the APR or even somehow get another upset, obviously Pitt is a lot more likely than Florida State or Clemson, then I think it's a solid A. But overall, I think it's hard to not be happy with what this season has become for Syracuse, especially because you can just watch game after game and see how much better this team has looked the last 2 weeks than it did, you know, weeks 2 and 3.
Yeah, you know what? I mean, and you and I bring this up almost every single week. This is looking more and more like Doug Marrone's first year. It's you look at it and you see 4-8. As a likely scenario, but even then you see an easy path to how it could have been 6-6, just like you did that year. There's one, like, you know, what the F game, and I think that's going to be the Wake Forest game, and no matter what happens for the rest of Baber's tenure, they're going to look back and say, like, that's going to be the game where you kind of scratch your head a little bit, you understand in part, but, you know, it's still going to be that, you know, damn, if we could just get that one back. I'd say that there were at least two of those games in Marone's first season. And I think Baber so far has won. But yeah, you see a lot of these similarities, but you see that kind of clear development. You see the clear change right from the get-go, and then you see that development and progress over the course of year one that shows you a much better product than what was inherited. And I think so far, I mean, again, we're 8 games in, you can already see it's a much better product than what was inherited. And I think by the end of the year, even if we lose out, everyone should be able to look at that, given the schedule and given what we were up against, as a success and as a clear sign that, you know, things are moving ahead very nicely. Dan, you're muted.
Yeah, my phone likes to do this thing where, like, there's blank, so I can't unmute myself when I go to try to press it.
That's fine.
Sometimes. Yeah, it's really annoying. Yeah, man, I pretty much agree with everything you said there. It's just, overall, like, you don't want to start talking about, like, outlooks on seasons when there's still 4 games left, but unfortunately, 2 of those games are Clemson and Florida State, and I think this year was we entered this year with such, like, a being so cognizant of the rebuild that we were in, that I think it's okay to, like, start to piece together, you know, here's how this is gone, and it really has filled expectations. I think we were promised, like, an exciting offense, and while things are definitely not, you know, firing on all cylinders, I think we definitely have gotten that, especially compared to the last couple of years. Like, it was hard to not be more exciting, and it's definitely a lot more so. And I almost, like, one of my great fears of this year was, like, the Babers offense would be installed and it just, like, would not even come close to resembling what he had at other schools, and, like, it being a Syracuse problem. And that's definitely not borne out. Like, this, I mean, you have Dungy tossing for 400 yards and running for 50, like, every week now. That, if anything, it's, like, very much resembles, at least in the passing part of the stat book, like, it's exactly what we thought we were going to get. Obviously, efficiency isn't quite where it is, and then the running game is a whole other issue, but we kind of know where the issues are there, which is good. Like, it's not like a mystery why the running game's bad. The offensive line has injuries all over the place and an experience all over the place, and you can just watch it and identify that, where, you know, the passing game, I think, has been, you know, it's not firing, you know, exactly what it will be in 2 years, but the fact that they can toss for 400 yards in Virginia Tech at all, even without a running game, is pretty impressive. So I'm pretty happy. I feel very good. I think we said this last week, like, as good as I felt as a Syracuse fan as I did heading into the 2014 season. And I don't expect a similar collapse in the next year or so. So pretty good.
Too true. Switching gears a little bit. to basketball, but first I wanted to point out, and I don't know why I've never noticed this before, do you know the name of Toledo's stadium?
I do not.
It's the Glass Bowl. Now why,
it's not a bowl.
Now why this isn't a source of comedy on a weekly basis for college football, I'm not sure. I would think, you know, I mean, granted, Toledo's not like Akron or Miami of Ohio, where you say, like, you know, the glass ball is broken, I think would be a common refrain.
I'm looking now. I'm assuming it was named after someone named Glass, because it doesn't make any sense otherwise. But also, it's not a bowl. Like, it's a stadium.
It's very clearly un-bowl-like.
I mean, I guess,
if you wanted it to be.
I mean, it's not like, filled on every side. I don't know. I'm picking nits. I need to find out why it's named after... let's see. No! Following World War II, the stadium was renovated with many glass elements. Because of this and the city's concentration on the industry, the stadium is named the Glass... It's like, that's something that should be, like, the nickname. It's, like, legitimately named the Glass Bowl.
And then Toledo's article about it on utrockets.com. Glass Bowl, one of America's great football stadiums.
One of... How many stadiums are in that list? Like, Glass one ball, of America's 400 stadium. Greatest football stadiums.
We're not going to tell you which, but it's one of them. Anyway, that was just...
What are the glass-like elements? I'm so confused. Like, we're going to derail this whole podcast.
Well, it's like,
what are the glass-like elements?
Well, why would you have glass elements in a place like Toledo that definitely gets really cold in the winter? I feel like that's not going to help you.
Also, in my eternal wisdom, Googling glass bowl just brings you up a lot of glass bowls.
Which, again, now we've come full circle on the conversation. This is what, like...
The SEO is terrible. They did not think this through in 1936.
No.
They did not think about the SEO ramifications of naming your stadium the Blast Bowl.
Way to go, guys. So, moving back on topic, before we get off topic again later in the podcast, I'm sure. That's why I pulled up this week's schedule, and that's how I got to the Glass Bowl jokes. ACC Media Day was today, and for listeners, yesterday, down in Charlotte. There was a whole lot of, you know, attending press, a lot of ESPN-related features. Jim Boeheim was on SportsCenter. He was also on ESPNU, along with Tyler Roberson and Dwan Coleman. We finished fifth in the media preseason poll. Dan, does that sound about right to you, based on kind of what's been said about the league in the long off season?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not totally shocked. It seems like everyone has been a good deal, like, less excited about this team than the Syracuse fans have been, which I guess makes sense.
That's fine.
I think I would probably slide them in, like, third or fourth, but I'm also, like, have been mystified by the ramification, like, the everything that comes with the transfers. Like, I've just been, my mind has been wrapped around, like, all the different rotation possibilities and how much potential this team has. So I think fifth is fair for, like, the national media who, and the ACC media who's less focused on that, but I think I maintain that I expect Syracuse to be one of the best teams in the ACC this year, by far, and I think it speaks more to, like, the depth of the ACC.
Yeah, you know, and I think, you know, Jim Boeheim talked about that a lot, and, like, I kind of said in the post I wrote up about his remarks on SportsCenter, like, he made some comparisons to this year's ACC versus the 2011 Big East, which had 11 teams in the tournament. I think there's some similarities just in terms of tournament caliber teams, but I think that the quality at the top for the ACC is probably a lot stronger. I think you look up and down, like, that Big East had maybe two or three teams at most that were looked at as national title contenders. I think there's five clear national title contenders in the ACC. I think Duke's a clear number one here. And then I think North Carolina is a pretty sizable bet at number two. But, you know, three through five, I think in any order, like, I'd be fine with Syracuse finishing anywhere in that three through five area. Virginia and Louisville have also added, you know, high-profile transfers. Austin Nichols is considered a potential All-ACC, you know, or even Player of the Year candidate. Transfer over from Memphis to Virginia, and he's someone who's supposed to, you know, kind of get UVA right back on track. After losing Malcolm Brogdon and some others. Again, it's a media preseason poll. I'm fine with fifth. I don't really care. I think anywhere in that one through five spot is you're looked at as an elite program and one that's going to contend for a Final Four berth. And I think, you know, going forward, at least as things stand right now, that five are the, in some order again every year, the five teams that are going to carry the banner for the ACC, and as long as those five are performing well, the ACC's fine. I mean, it definitely helps, though, that you look down the rest of this list, and I mean the margin between NC State at six, which I don't buy at all, and Virginia Tech at 10 is razor thin. I think you can even go as far down as Wake, maybe even Georgia Tech. I've seen Georgia Tech projected as high as like eighth by some folks. Really, everything 6 through 14 is pretty fluid, except for 15. Boston College, obviously, being absolute trash as an athletic program, other than hockey, and having no idea how to run a basketball program or football program. BC brought in three grad transfers this year to try to stop some of the bleeding. But when you make a bad hire, I can't necessarily say that just getting the players you think you need is what's going to fix it.
Yeah, I mean, do we think BC, do they get an ACC to win this year? I'm going to say they probably get one, right?
Here's the problem. I think they're better, but I think everybody else is also better. Like, every single team here is better than they were last year.
Yeah, the league as a whole, I think, takes a pretty big step forward, and like you said, I struggle to see a team that's not at least as good as it were last year.
Right. And that's the thing. You look at this league compared to last year. Like, this is the same league that got four teams into the Elite Eight, two teams into the Final Four, set a record for the most teams in the Sweet 16 for one conference. Like, the fact that league got better is mind-blowing, and that's a really bad sign for Boston College and, to a lesser extent, you know, the Wake Forest and Georgia Techs of the world. I think if you wanted to make a demarcation line, you could after Pitt. I think a 12th-place team in any conference is in a bad state of affairs, except for in the ACC, where a 12th-place Pitt could easily play themselves up to a 7th-place finish.
Yeah, Pitt has, like, 4 starters back, and they were pretty decent last year. Like, I think Pitt's probably a little underrated, even within the terms of the ACC, but, like, the fact that it's conceivable for them to finish 12th with, like, bringing back a lot of talent and being a generally reliable, solid team at worst, like, that tells you all you need to know about this league.
Yeah, and, I mean, you look down the list, too, like, 12 teams received votes in the initial coaches poll. Now, yes, it's the coaches poll. I'd like to put a little more stock in the AP poll, perhaps. I think you'll also see a better – the AP poll also give you a much better kind of view of which of these teams might be able to join that top five group, especially after the first few weeks, because I feel like, you know, again, the ACC media is going to be North Carolina heavy. They're going to be Virginia heavy. Those traditional powers are always going to get more votes, and that's probably how you get an NC State at 6, despite – I'd put Florida State ahead of them, maybe Virginia Tech and Miami as well. I know Clemson got some love in the Ken Pomeroy initial rankings. And yeah, I agree with you. I think Pitt's a little underrated. But yeah, the AP poll is at least a little bit more indicative of at least from, you know, Texas eastward, better view of what's going on in college basketball. While coaches, you know, obviously, whether it's them or interns, there's definitely a little bit of kind of throwaway polling that can and does happen, some name recognition stuff that can and does happen. There's no way that, especially if you don't play most of these teams, and a lot of these coaches don't, that you really truly know, you know, what's going on in each of these programs and can you know, properly evaluate 25 teams without them playing a game. I think the media, it's their job. No, they're not perfect, especially when it comes to covering West Coast teams, but I would trust their metrics a little bit more. I'm looking forward to seeing that initial AP poll when it comes out to see if SU is closer to 17th or so like they were in the coaches poll, or if we see a bit of a rise based on, you know, just the media taking some more time to digest and understand the additions there.
Yeah, I am interested to see it as well. Anytime I see the AP poll or the coaches poll and like comparison between the two, I think to myself, how long do you think Jim Boeheim spends filling this out? And this is
0.0 minutes.
That's the correct answer, because you know he has like his son fill it out or an intern.
But he has like rules. You know he has rules though.
Oh, like who can only be so high?
Yeah, like I'm sure he has a rule. Like I'm sure Jim Boeheim hates Ben Majors. I am sure.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Unless they've beaten him before.
Yeah, unless they've beaten him. I'm sure he says that. He probably has a Syracuse can go no lower than X, but no higher than Y, because he never wants to be the person who votes SU the highest.
I think he has before. I think he's been the voter when we've been number one and it's been like unanimous.
Unanimous, yes. But I mean, like, as far as like, he never wants to be like the only guy.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I think he says like no higher than X because he wants to make sure that like he's not the outlier.
Yeah, for sure.
In the voting process. And I feel like he's. He'll definitely favor ACC teams because he understands the optics of, especially ones that we're going to face, understands the optics of beating a ranked team versus not, even if at the end of the year they may not be one.
Also, like back when we were in the Big East, you know he voted for like 11 Big East teams every week.
Oh, yeah, he did. You know what? If it was up to him, he would make the entire top 25 now be the old Big East. the ACC... And I don't know. Pick a team. You probably just put Cornell in there. This is my top 25. Eat it, America. On that note, what have you been drinking, Dan? Give it some halftime, then continue on to more basketball stuff and college football schedule.
I'd say the most fall-ish thing I had was on Monday. I was in Brooklyn and had a Cat Still Brewery, their Oktoberfest. Obviously, it's an upstate brewery. Really nice. I think with Oktoberfest, like, it feels like everyone just kind of dips into the same well, and a lot of them taste very, very similar. And this wasn't very different from that. But I think a solid Oktoberfest is a very drinkable, good beer. And it's hard for... I don't find a lot of bad Oktoberfests. So it was definitely cool with that. And then last Friday, there was actually a Syracuse alumni event down in the financial district, which had specials on Oscar Blues. So I had a bunch of Pinners. I had a bunch of Dales. I had a bunch of Deviant Dales. All I think I had a not Oscar Blues, but I think I believe I had a Cigar City High Life. Yeah, so a bunch of that, which was all great. That's pretty much it. If my standard drinking was like a bunch of Oscar Blues and a High Life, I think that's a pretty decent week.
Agreed. On my end, I mentioned a couple times there is a great place over by the Hermosa Beach Pier. Called Mediterraneo, and their Friday happy hour deal from 5 to 7 is buy one, get one on small plates and half-price drafts. So they always have Russian River Blind Pig on, and I proceed to drink a lot of those. Also stopped over at Brautenbrau, this German place right over there, had a German IPA. It's Braufachtum Pragusta from... Raderberger Group. So yeah, that was pretty good. Definitely a little bit different than your traditional IPA, but did enjoy it. A buddy of mine and I were feeling like we wanted an aggressive nightcap, so we got the 1 liter steins each. That was a regrettable decision. Also had breweries Melange number 10. It was kind of like a horchata Mexican hot chocolate hybrid kind of imperial stout, which was very, very good. Had a Wiki Wiki tart from the brewery. Believe, boysenberry, a few other things going on, just a standard sour ale. Had a Captain's Daughter from Grace Ale Brewing. A friend of mine sent that out. And then last night I was over at Staples Center for the Kings Blue Jackets game and grabbed a Torpedo Extra IPA from Sierra Nevada. That was my drinking.
Very nice. I should mention, just as news out here in the New York area, if you are a New York City area alum, the Big Apple Orange has switched their official bar for the season to Fifth and Mad, which is, as you can probably guess, on Fifth and Madison. I have not been there yet, but it should be pretty good. Obviously, last year we were at Social, which got really, really awesome down the stretch of the tournament. So hopefully we'll see some of you guys, see you around there. That is, I know it just happened. So for those in the city who listen to this, that is the new spot.
I am mostly positive we're still at the same place, the Parlor in West Hollywood over here, if I had to guess.
And if I'm not there, if I'm coming from work, I will be in Hoboken, and the Syracuse alumni spot in Hoboken is Hoboken Bar and Grill, which I have been to a lot of like Bid Mondays for, and I know they are looking to up their attendance as well. So you may find me, and you can buy me a drink, or you can ask me to buy you a drink in one of those two places for Syracuse basketball this year.
Fair enough. Also, speaking of football this weekend, as I mentioned before, I will be headed out to Utah, be at the Utah-Washington game. Should be a great time. I'll be game day. I will definitely...
What time do you have to be up for game day? Like 6 a.m.?
Pacific time zone, game day starts at 6. Mountain time zone, at least 7.
Yeah, it's not too bad.
Not too bad. So my buddies and I will definitely be bringing a sign that says it's not their fault they didn't know.
That's fantastic.
I fully expect to be on game day. So I would hope that any of the listeners or commenters grabs themselves a screenshot, because that will be a good time, because based on how much ESPN's gone all in on that quote and that speech, I feel like it seems pretty likely. We also never see Syracuse stuff when we're not involved in game day, so I feel like it'll be an anomaly in some ways.
Yeah, if only we had like the Clemson game this week, because that would be hilarious if you had like a Dabo themed. Dabo didn't know.
It's not his fault.
And then we'd proceed to get beaten by 45 because Dabo would use it as disrespect. But
he would. Oh god, yeah. So I'll be there, and I'll have plenty of Utah beers to report back on next week.
Are they allowed to brew beer in Utah?
They are, surprisingly. They have laws around what they can and can't brew and where they can and can't sell it, but they are allowed to brew it.
Good for them.
Yeah, way to go, guys. Okay. So, do you need to talk any more college basketball, or can we switch back to what we usually prefer to talk about, which is college football and all the games going on without Syracuse playing this week?
I'm fine talking college football. I mean, I feel I feel like Media Day wasn't that great. I mean, our representatives are Roberson and Pullman, and love those guys.
Quiet.
Maybe the most quiet, non. You weren't Nardell often there. It's not like Benajay last year. Benajay is a total goofball. Like, Tyler Roberson, I feel like, would rather never speak to another human again if it was possible.
The truth.
He just wants rebounds. That's all he wants. He just wants rebounds, no talks.
Well, I know, like, I was talking, you know, that great Donna DeTota feature about him over the summer, and I was talking to her about it. Like, has a four-year player at SU, have you ever known less about one? And she honestly said, like, she did not know a damn thing about him. Just because, like, he's so cut off. She said, like, he mentioned his brother or something, and she's like, had no idea he had a brother. Like, zero clue. And, like, it's because he's just such a, like, closed-off guy. But, like, yeah, I can honestly say I don't think I've known this little about a four-year contributor as I do about Roberson.
Especially when you compare him to, like, the last couple. Like, Rack, we knew everything about. Benajay, we learned a lot about in, like, the year of his star turn. Even Lydon, like, obviously he hasn't been here for 4 years, but, like, I feel like we know a lot about Tyler Lydon. We know that he likes to buy Chipotle and then eat it at Moe's, which is an absolutely savage thing to do, and I appreciate it at a number of levels. Our basketball team, like, for a couple of years now has been very open and in, like, a mostly good way. Like, I think we've found out a lot about these guys' personalities, and they're really interesting in a number of different ways. And Roberson is just not, and it's not like a bad thing at all. It's just, no. You know, how he chooses to live his life. Roberson is definitely one of the more, you know, closed off, and that's fine. I mean, it's not like he doesn't answer media questions, and he's not like standoffish by any means. It's just very much like keeps to himself, and that's cool. Like, that's who he is. So hopefully he has a nice breakout season, and we can learn a little bit more about him on his terms. And there obviously was that awesome Donna piece, and her profiles are always so good. But yeah, definitely not the most exciting person you could have in terms of, like, quotes and drumming up intrigue for the season at Media Days. But he's a senior, and he deserved, you know, the honor. So hopefully he had a good time down in was it in Charlotte?
Yeah.
Yeah, so hopefully he had a good time in Charlotte.
Yeah, definitely.
And
I think
they want to.
Like, that's the interesting thing with you know, quieter guys in the SU team is, like, they're few and far between, I think, because of the atmosphere that Jim kind of creates. It's very, yes, we're always team-based, and obviously the zone defense is team-based, but I feel like Jim does like to recruit individuals and guys that can handle the spotlight and guys can handle pressure. And obviously, like, you know, Syracuse is a small city, but during basketball season, I think the Syracuse fan base balloons tenfold, and the pressures on you at SU would rival most of the other schools in the nation, say maybe Kentucky, Duke, and North Carolina. I think he kind of looks to recruit a certain type of guy, a certain type of attitude about him. And, like, you see a lot of the guys that succeed, you know, from, you know, Jerry to Eric Devendorf and Malachi Richardson and Johnny Flynn. And the list can go on. These are guys that, you know, embrace and you know, kind of bask in the limelight, you know, for better or for worse, and they kind of feed off of that. So it's interesting when we see, you know, a guy like Roberson, and I think, again, like SU, as fans, we gravitate so much toward these personalities and these individuals that end up telling the story of SU basketball over the decades. And again, it is interesting to see someone like Roberson kind of, you know, toil away. I mean, even a guy like Bemo Cicada, I felt like we knew a ton about, and he kind of embraced it by the end, understanding, like, how much his personality told the story. And it'll be interesting to see if Roberson does the same. Dad.
Yeah, I hate my phone. It just did the thing again. It's like I'm sitting there looking at it and trying to unmute it. And it's just like every time I go to put my finger anywhere near it, it's like, nope, blank screen.
Nope.
Like, what? How is this a feature? I totally agree. And I think a lot of it will be based on, you know, his play this year. He's an interesting player. He's a sometimes frustrating player. I do think if we get, like, some sort of leap from him, though, I mean, at his best, he's such a unique talent, and he's this double-double machine who eats up some of the better teams on the schedule. It's not like he's, you know, only shows up against weak opponents, like people said about Rack heading into his senior year when he then exploded and became like a superstar. Roberson does, like, I mean, he kills Duke. Like, that's his best games in his career are, like, I'd say probably three of his four best games ever, and it's Duke. So if he can bring that every night, it adds a crazy dimension to this team, and this team that already has a lot of dimensions to speak of, at least on paper.
Too true. So, yeah, college football. I feel like we've talked way too much about basketball, considering how still in the middle of football season we are. We are going to have a season preview show. Dan and I just need to sort those details out. I think we'll probably have to try to do two separate podcasts for football and basketball that week. But again, these are things we'll deal with offline. One of my favorite college football happenings last week, Tulane's helmets. Tulane didn't just put Wavy the Wave on the helmet. They put Wavy the Wave as the helmet, pretty much. The only thing that would have made it better is if they decided to put his eyes on the front and then the wave going backwards, kind of like UConn's helmets, but no.
And have his scowl painted on the mast?
Oh, yeah. Now that would have...
Someday.
Someday, we can dream. I saw that gigantic Wavy the Wave they have somewhere in the athletic department. I will definitely be going to pay tribute down in New Orleans before headed to Baton Rouge next year.
Yeah, I almost feel like we joke about, like, you know, sparking a fire under USC and all this. I have to imagine that just because we have some weird relationship with, like, the scant Tulane media out there, based on our constant talking about them, there's no way that, like, our love for Wavy the Wave hasn't somehow reached Tulane, because they have been playing it up so much, and I just thoroughly appreciate them. We are Syracuse fans, and we have Syracuse in our hearts, and the athletic department does a lot of things to annoy us in that regard. Tulane is the athletic department that just knows what we
want.
Caters
to us.
They cater directly to us.
Give the people what they want. Tulane gets
whether or not they know they're doing it, it doesn't really matter. They just know what we feel in our hearts as fake Tulane fans, and they just give it directly to us on a strangely regular basis.
They have to know. Their AD retweeted me once. Then there was that
time. Okay, so.
Then there was the time that I was sending you those links at like 10 o'clock at night of like all the Wavy the Wave shit you can buy in the Tulane store. Like, I considered buying a 10 by 5 Wavy the Wave flag and putting it outside my house. Like, just for the hell of it.
A lot of love getting into New Orleans, starting with the 2012. Final Four, where if we had beat Ohio State, Sean and I were going to get to go. And then the following year, I was going to go to the Tulane football game, and I had a death in the family, so I had to cancel that, like, last minute. And then I'm supposed to go to the game in Baton Rouge last year, and next year, and have a wedding that I'm in. Shout out to Adam. He listens. Yeah, thanks for planning. We've joked about this.
Ball
it wasn't his fault. Yeah, he planned, I don't know why we're talking about this, but whatever. He planned his wedding for the weekend that it is. And as you remember, the LSU game was supposed to be the weekend before. And then LSU moved it, and he couldn't move his wedding because, you know, you can't do that. So, yeah. So, 3-0 for 3 in getting down to Louisiana, but it will happen eventually. And when it does, I'll probably have been on, you know, some kind of bender and wind up buying some Tulane stuff.
That's fine. Yeah, I'm definitely hitting up Tulane and seeing if I can get, like, a tour of the athletic department before I get down there. I'm, like, I'm not even kidding.
John's just going to get a job at Tulane.
Yeah, I'm going to leave one LA for the other LA. Perfect. My wife is thrilled. All right.
It's what we've always wanted.
Yeah, that's exactly what we've always wanted. So, Dan... Why don't we get started with a game that we already kind of touched on a little bit this week? And we don't have to go in depth on these at all, because I know most Syracuse fans have already tuned out once the Tulane talk started. Utah, Washington. Obviously, you know, Joe Williams looked phenomenal against UCLA, who is trash this year for some stupid reason. And if there's one troll move that USC still has in them, it's hiring Jim Mora away from UCLA. maybe do it, USC. I just kind of want to see it. Not going to lie. Be kind of funny. That said, because Clay Helton kind of turned it around and suddenly USC looks like a team full of 4 and 5 stars, I don't think you are. Again, you're welcome for sparking you to this glorious comeback and how once again you're going to contend for a Pac-12 South title despite being the third or fourth best team in the division. Again, whatever. But what do you see out of Utah that could potentially spur an upset against what looks like an unstoppable death machine in Washington?
I think, I don't know, I have a weird feeling about that game. I just think Utah at night, I guess it's actually kind of early there. It's, what, 3:30 Eastern, so...
1:30.
It's not true, yeah, so it's not at night. But Utah, like, I feel...
You can go for it.
Yeah, I feel like it's, there have been a lot of big, high-profile games there, and they're usually, like, Thursday, Friday nights since the Pac-12, but they just seem to win big games at home, and I just feel like it's not going to be that easy for Washington. And they still could make the playoff with a loss if they win the Pac-12. But, like, it just seems too obvious that Washington's going to run through this conference. And I just have this weird feeling that Utah is going to knock them off. I understand that I did not give you any reasons for it. But Utah plays solid D. They run the ball. They control the clock. They bring running backs out of retirement to then get, like, 200 yards. I just think that this is a – they play a type of, like, close clock control style that you see a lot of teams try when playing a top opponent, and they just happen to have a decent amount of talent and are really well coached. So I think this one will be close no matter what. I think the 10-point, I think it's like a 10 or 10 and a half point line is way too much.
Oh yeah,
in favor of Washington. And I don't know, I just have a very strange feeling that Utah pulls this one out.
See, I'm having some of the same. And that is because, like, Utah manages some crazy things at Rice-Eccles. On top of that, look over Washington's schedule again and tell me where the good team they've beaten yet is. And this is not to hate on Washington, but look down that schedule, and honestly, Baylor's schedule compares more favorably. If you take away the brand names and you take away the rankings that these teams might have had at the beginning of the season, blowout win over Rutgers, blowout win over Idaho, blowout win over Portland State. You barely beat Arizona, who's trash. You destroyed Stanford, but Stanford has revealed themselves to be nothing more than trash. Oregon, you scored 70 points on, which I applaud, and I think that is one of the better revenge moves I've seen in college football. That said, Oregon is one of the, if not the worst, passing defense in the entire country.
It's the worst.
It's the worst.
It's literally the worst.
Confirmed. And then Oregon State, also garbage. Like, so who has Washington really beat to this point? The answer is no one. And that doesn't mean they can't beat everybody left on the schedule. But I, as much as I like this Utah team, this Washington team a lot, and I would love to see them in the playoff, this is a team that could lose 3 more games this year. Like, no joke. The Utah game, the USC game, and the Washington State game are all very ripe for losses. And because of how bad the Pac-12 North is, it still might come down, even if they suffer a loss here against USC, to the Apple Cup game.
Yeah, it just, and I can't even really blame them, because it's not like you go into the year expecting Oregon and Stanford to, like,
and everybody else in the Pac-12
horrid and mediocre, respectively. But that's just how it played out. So I think you're right. I feel pretty safe in calling Washington a for sure top 10 team. Like,
oh, yeah.
It's not like they've been close. Like, except for the Arizona game, which was super weird. They've been crushing people. But Utah's legit. I think Wazoo is good and super weird, and you don't want to. I wouldn't want to face them with a playoff game on the line, especially with how vindictive and awful Mike Leach can be about things.
For a noon 30er the day after Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
And definitely is that on the Blues? Oh, yeah. Definitely in snow.
Yeah. These are the two spots, as you identified. Both teams that will that step up for big games. Utah, they're dead opposites. Like, Utah plays this very run-oriented style with solid defense. Wazoo is a crazy Mike Leach offense and sneakily getting better defense, and they can actually run the ball, like, a little bit. They're, like, as different as two teams can be. And I would not want to play either of them with a playoff on the line and on the road. And that's exactly what Washington has to do. So I just feel like it's too obvious for Washington to run the table. It's just like they didn't they came up from such like a weird place where they had all this hype going in, and after coming off a 7-6 part of Dallas Bowl year, it just seems too convenient for them to just totally run the table and go. They could still, like I said, they could lose one of these games and then win the Pac-12 and go, just because I still think there's a lot that we have to see shake out with like West Virginia and Baylor, and the Big Ten has to work itself out. But I struggle to see them going undefeated, and Utah is probably the most obvious spot, with the apple truck being a close second in terms of where they could falter.
And the thing is, like, Utah hasn't, like, Utah's really close to being undefeated as well, and against a better schedule, I'd contend. You know, BYU is a fairly good team. I'd say San Jose State, you know, their record might not show it, but they're recruiting better than most of the group of five right now. Again, they shouldn't have lost that Cal game. They beat USC in one of my favorite games of the year so far. They beat Arizona by more. Doesn't really mean anything, but whatever. And then they went at UCLA in a game when UCLA threw about 70 times and seemed to have an offense again. Utah can actually afford a loss, I think, more than Washington can, especially if that loss is to Washington. That Colorado game looms at the end of the season as a really fun, unexpected potential Pac-12 South play-in game. There's a lot to like about Utah. There's a lot to like about Washington as well. But yeah, this isn't to trash anybody. It's just to say that the Utes do look interesting, and they look like a team that maybe last year we got a little ahead of ourselves. Maybe this year is the year that Utah really contends for playoff berth.
Yeah, I was going to bring the same thing up. I think Utah, and this just struck me, they remind me a ton of 2014 Georgia Tech. Stylistically, obviously, they're different. But like they run through the schedule. They have like one loss midway through. But like if they win this game, that Colorado game, like you said, becomes like super intriguing. But if they win this game and then they get a rematch against Washington in the Pac-12 championship and win it, like, it'd be hard to keep them out, especially when their one loss is, what, 5-5 on the road at Cal, which is, like, a weird game. They should have won in a weird game. And obviously, they probably need a little help, but, like, they remind me of that. It just seems like they're a similar team. Obviously, Washington and Florida State aren't quite the same, but they are very much in it. Obviously, they're not an obvious pick right now, but if they win this, then you'll start to hear some buzz on Utah, I think, big time.
I think they'll be a top 7 or 8 team if they win this game, to be honest, because like one of Nebraska and Wisconsin has to lose this week because they're facing one another. Again, everyone would love to see Baylor just not be in the top 10. I think A&M might be putting the cart before the horse. Florida State, a team that's in front of Utah right now. I think if they win, I think Clemson could fall behind Utah. If Florida State loses, Florida State's definitely falling behind Utah. I mean, there's a lot of teams in front of them that are just going to fall by default this week. And again, that makes it interesting to see, you know, and this isn't to bank on a Utah win. Although, I mean, I'm not rooting for anybody on Saturday. I'm just rooting for a fun game. But, I do feel like, you know, a Utah win definitely vaults them right into the playoff conversation, even more so than they were last year.
Yeah, and based on now the two teams that are hinging this coming up in the last like 5 minutes, I've thought about writing about this. I just need to find the evidence, as it was like two things that like flew way under the radar. But I'm presenting a Joey Galloway curse for college football. Every year, Joey Galloway has one team in his playoff that doesn't make a lot of sense. In 2015, ahead of last year, and I distinctly remember this, he chose Georgia Tech to go to the playoff. This is coming off of their very nice year. And, like, okay, but Georgia Tech, like, you know, they were really good, but did everyone expect them to, like, go to the playoff? No, I think people expected them to be better than 3-9. They went 3-9. This year, his kind of out-of-the-box playoff pick was UCLA. Yeah. UCLA is awful.
Well, their offensive line just decided to let Josh Rosen die. And they're going to ruin Josh Rosen.
Yes. I think next year, if he goes and makes some weird prediction where, like, he has Nebraska going to the playoff and Nebraska goes 4-8, I think we officially have a thing where Joey Galloway will straight up curse one of the teams before the season. And not just, like, they're going to miss the playoffs and 8-4. Like, Joey Galloway will pick you to make the playoff, and you will fall off a cliff, and you will go 4-8 or 3-9, and you will just be horrendous. I really hope that this is proven true by history.
Counter to the Joey Galloway curse, because it's funny you mentioned him, because I do have a Joey Galloway factoid to share. Joey Galloway picked Syracuse to win the Big East in 2012.
I do remember that, and he was widely mocked, and it ended up being true-ish.
The only prudent... A four-way tie, whatever.
The Big East in 2012, you had like a solid 40% chance to get it right if you just picked anyone. So, yeah.
Just let it be known that that was the only chance Rutgers has ever had to win a real conference outright, and they proceeded to not do so because they just couldn't
Because they lost to an ass UConn team.
Yeah.
At home, I think.
Way to go,
if guys. I remember correctly.
Way to go.
Speaking of UConn, LOL. Moving on.
Oh, man. This whole week for them has just been great. The fact that the Civil Conflict trophy was left on the field.
I laughed. I, like, legitimately laughed really hard when I saw that happen. Like, when I read those tweets, I was like, this is the greatest. This is the greatest thing that's ever happened.
The thing is, like, UConn fans are actually pissed about, like, not, they're not pissed about the trophy being left. They're just pissed about Diaco at this point. It was like, I saw No Escalators was tweeting about it, and, like, the UConn blog did, too. Like, it's just stupid. Like, he just doubled down on the whole thing.
And then pretended like he didn't. Like, right. It's baffling because it's, A, it was so stupid to begin with. Like, it was goofy when it happened. It's still stupid. But, like, it's obfuscating, like, the fact that Diaco is probably a pretty decent coach. And, like, while UConn isn't having a great season, like, you have pretty baseline expectations of, like, it's going to take a while for UConn to be consistently good if they ever do get that. Right. And he's won some games that he shouldn't win. Like, Bob Diaco is, like, nowhere near, like, the hot seat or anything. Like, he's done a very good job at UConn.
And
he's pissing people off because the only attention UConn gets, aside from like a minute when they beat Houston last year, when they beat Navy this year, like the only attention that UConn's getting, oh, they didn't beat Navy. They beat Cincinnati.
Navy. And
they lost to Navy because they decided not to run a last play. They beat Cincinnati, which like looks good, but then like you look at Cincinnati, you're like, that's not actually that good. Either way, like the attention they're getting is for this really stupid campaign that he led to start this rivalry that no one else is interested in. I don't think UConn's interested in it. Like, they don't care. He's the only one who cares. And then everyone's like, well, you made this a big deal. And then he's like, no, I didn't. And UCF was totally into it. And like, no, they said at the moment they didn't want to be a part of it. They said the following year they didn't want to be a part of it. They very clearly don't want to be a part of it now. At no point has UCF ever indicated any interest in this trophy. And Bob Diaco is just trying to make it a thing. And Bob, fetch is not a thing. You can't make it a thing. You can't make fetch happen.
So good. All right. So to end our show, Dan, if you had to pick right now, and that's not based on what teams currently look like, it's knowing what the schedule lays out as, because as people who talk about college football and write about college football, we usually have a good idea of where the rest of the road stands for these teams. Who is your top four, if you had to say today?
Top four today, not projecting forward.
Oh, no, projecting forward. Well, yeah, projecting forward. Like, knowing what you know about the rest of these schedules. I mean, you don't have to go exact. But knowing what you know about a lot of these remaining schedules, who are you seeing slotted into this thing?
All right. I think Alabama is clear number one. I do not see them losing. They just look so good.
What about Auburn?
That'd be hilarious. Auburn does look like they they, like, found their spirit animal. Like, Auburn decided mid-year, like, oh, yeah, remember when we were really good when we just ran the ball 80% of the time and did it in interesting ways and played good D? And so good on Gus Malzahn to, like, rediscover what made his team good. You know, novel idea after 2 years.
Just eating Brett Bielema alive.
I picked Arkansas in that game, and I was like, oh, Auburn's not for real. Like, we'll see. And then they just devoured Arkansas. I was like, oh, okay.
It makes me very much reevaluate that Clemson-Auburn game from the beginning of the year.
Well, that was because if you watch that, like watching that game was the most perplexing. I was like mad. I don't care about Auburn in the least. I have no opinions about Auburn, like in terms of like whether I like them or not. I was getting angry at Gus Malzahn for how he handled his quarterbacks. It was the most bizarre handling of a quarterback situation since Mike Vealey decided to announce that we were going to run a trick play before it happened when Tony Catalina ran onto the field. He was rotating guys in and like play by play. It was insane. So he finally just like Sean White is the least bad, and then we're gonna run the ball with Kerryon Johnson and who's the other guy whose name is escaping me? They both have K names. Oh, yeah. I was just writing the other day. We're very professional. I'm a college football writer. I read about this every day. Yeah, they have like 1,200. They have like 1,200 yards and 12 touchdowns between them. They do their interesting like option based stuff, and then they do all their just pulling. And it's such a cool running attack that isn't really used anywhere else. And it's just like they weren't running that offense for like a year and a half. So I'm very glad to see them back at it. I think Alabama probably beats them by like 10 at Jordan Herr. I think it should be like fairly competitive. But I think Alabama's just really good. Michigan and Ohio State is tough. It's got to be one of those two. I think you just have to lean Michigan just based on the way they beat people. And you know they're going to be out for like bloodthirsty revenge this year. And Ohio State, I think we just see their warts a little bit more. And their youth kind of showed itself at Penn State. I do think there's a very good chance that, like, between now and then they develop. And because those guys are so young and there's so many sophomores involved. I feel like it's a coin flip-ish game. And I'm, like, 52% confident that Michigan wins it. And I think they'll beat Wisconsin or whomever they face in the title game. I'm sticking with Clemson. I'm not super impressed by Clemson, but I just feel like
the tiebreakers are in their favor at this point.
The tiebreakers are in their favor. I think they'll beat Florida State. I think they'll probably run the table and get, I'll say, the 3 seed, just because I think Michigan will probably at this point run the table. And this all seems like it's going to work out too easily. So I think we talked to Washington and Utah. We both kind of seem like we think Washington will drop one here. I'm going to say Washington loses. I'm going to say Utah doesn't make it. I don't trust Baylor or West Virginia. I think they're both good teams. I do not trust them. I think Louisville's going to get it. I think Louisville sneaks into the 4 spot as an at-large for the first time in playoff history. And I think in that scenario, Louisville-Alabama, sign me up.
Oh, boy.
Well, like, you know, Alabama, the only thing that takes down Nick Saban Alabama teams is superstar, like, top-level quarterbacks that can run. Like, look at all the quarterbacks that have beaten Saban recently. Chad Kelly, obviously Deshaun Watson didn't beat him, but, like, easily could have. Like, it was a special teams side of that game. Johnny Manziel, the one superhero performance from Trevor Knight, who is not as good as he was in that game, but was, like, amazing in that game when he was at Oklahoma. Like, they all kind of profile this one way, and Lamar Jackson is a better athlete in terms of running the ball than any of them. And he's improving as a passer by like the minute. I don't think that Louisville would win that game, but I think they would put the fear of God in Nick Saban that whole week or that whole like month build up. So sign me up for that.
Well, I'd be curious to see how the committee handles that, because what we haven't seen necessarily maybe we did a little bit in the first year. Though I don't think Trayvon Boykin was necessarily what Lamar Jackson is by any means, but I think leaving out college football's best player when there's a clear argument to be had would be a very tough call for them, especially when they don't really use advanced metrics or analytics to separate these teams at all. It's really just an open discussion of what ends up being, to me, brand awareness, marketability, which players are you know, most kind of notable for the product, which is the college football playoff. I do think you're right. I think if Washington can drop a game, but I just don't know if they end up dropping two. I think that Louisville can get in based on strength of schedule over a one-loss Baylor or West Virginia, because if you look at the rest of that conference, if either of those teams have one loss, that means that Oklahoma probably has at least 3. That means that if both of those teams have one loss, something else has happened. Again, there's just a lot of, there's too much to digest. I don't think an undefeated Western Michigan or Boise State gets in to the top 4, but I'd be very curious to see if a lot of the at-large teams take on water, if you could see two group of 5 teams get in, a la, what was it, 2010? When TCU and Boise faced one another in the Fiesta Bowl?
Somewhere around there.
Yeah, 2010.
If they both went undefeated, I don't know. Could they even make that happen? Could they get both of those in a New Year's Six game? Because they'd have to put one in.
You have to put one in by mandate, but then I'm curious the other. It would really just depend on how much...
What everyone else looked like.
It would everyone else look like. Because the one good thing about this system is that it's not like the old one with BCS, where the only guaranteed spots were like the top four, and then everything else. Like, you could just leapfrog with brand up to like 12 or 14 or whatever it was. So as long as...
Which is why you had like 10-3 Georgia in a great game every year, even though like half the time they weren't that good.
Yeah, or like Notre Dame getting smoked by Oregon State and like the Sugar Bowl.
You mean everyone? You mean every year?
Every year, everyone. But yeah, that I think it'd be unlikely. But you know, Bill Connelly had a great article on SB Nation today talking about how likely it is a lot of these top teams take on two losses by end of year, and that would kind of test the committee a bit to see if both teams could leap. But that's a conversation for another day. I'll give my quick playoff picks, and then we can give people their lives back after over an hour of talking. I agree with you on Bama. I think Auburn's going to test them. I don't think anyone from the East is going to touch them. It's going to be another Atlanta coronation ceremony for those guys. I think Michigan's too good and too vengeful. Two of their final opponents, obviously they have a bone to pick with. That's Michigan State and Ohio State. If they're going to drop one, it's one of those. But I see Michigan getting through. I think Clemson gets through. And then, yeah, that fourth spot's tough. West Virginia and Baylor haven't played the caliber of non-conference schedules that they need to really hold up with a loss. I think even if Washington's there, I think if you look at if you're between a one-loss Washington and a one-loss Baylor or Western Michigan, I think you're going with Washington. I think that the Big 12 situation just kind of cannibalizes one another. I think a one-loss Washington might get pushed out by Louisville, like you said. The one issue for Louisville, one blessing and curse for Louisville is going to be their last group of opponents are an improving but still not great Kentucky team, Virginia, BC, and Wake. So you're going to have four games no one cares about, but also four opportunities for Lamar Jackson to put up video game numbers again. And that's going to be kind of the bar, is that can you lay waste to these teams? Because that's going to be the mandate on them. Like, this was kind of the case for a bunch of other teams in the past, where like you know, both post-playoff and pre-playoff of like, can you just destroy teams as best you can? And I think that's in part how Ohio State got in over TCU and Baylor. You know, even going way back into BCS, I think it's how, you know, Colorado might have gotten screwed out of playing for championships. Same with Oregon in the past. Like, it was style points. And I think Louisville's going to be playing for style points. And Bobby Petrino is very good at just spite beating the hell out of opponents. And I think he'll do it if it means kind of putting them apart from, you know, your Washington and Baylor and West Virginia. But again, that assumes that both West Virginia and Baylor lose a game. If one of them doesn't, and obviously one of them has to because they play each other on the last weekend, I think an undefeated Big 12 team unfortunately gets in, despite the fact that I think they'd be worse than several one-loss teams, including Washington and Louisville.
Yeah, and real quick, we actually talked about this in the office and had an article to open about it on the Spun. The dream situation for, I guess, probably blue blood college football fans and also the people who run college football is you have Ohio State beat Michigan in like a classic, and then Ohio State win the Big Ten title, and Michigan didn't and is not large, and then you have a semifinal of Alabama Clemson title rematch or Alabama Louisville, if you like that, and then you have the Dame rematch in the other semifinal, and everyone in college football that makes any money would just go nuts. Yeah.
Alas. All right. That's a fun note to end on. Dan, thank you as always for joining. Much appreciated.
Yes. Look forward to beating the byes this week.
Yep. We'll be facing the fighting byes. It's on ESPN 8, The Ocho, for those who are looking to find it. But that was Dan. I'm John. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in to a bi-week edition of Troyanians at Absolute Podcast. Be sure to rate, review, subscribe on iTunes, on Blog Talk, and whatever other service you use. And go Orange.
Go Orange. Thank you.